Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure there'll be a few late arrivals, but I think we should start, given it's just past the advertised time. A very warm welcome to the Institute of Actuaries and on behalf of the Finance, Investment and Risk Management Board. A particular welcome to our guests from PREMIA, the Professional Risk Managers International Association. This is the first of what's hoped to be a series of joint events with them on the subject of risk management, which has been organised through the Risk Management Special Interest Group, which we've set up under the board here. So we hope to have a number of such events, and I shall be advertising the next ones at the end of this evening, but I'll leave that till then. First of all, a piece of housekeeping. For those who wish to claim CPD points from the Institute of Actuaries, there's a series of clipboards which need to be signed. There's in fact one for each block of chairs at the front. So if those who are at the front would like to sign their names and then pass it to the back, that will cover that. So without more ado, I'd like to introduce our speakers this evening. We're very, very pleased that we've got two very, very distinguished speakers from the Netherlands to come and speak this evening. There are many people who say that the Netherlands has the best pensions system in the world. So I'm hoping that there'll be plenty that they have to teach us. We'll be hearing from, first of all, a quick introduction from Theo Cochran on my right. It's his book that you all have a copy of on your chairs. I hope you'll all take away and read and digest that after the event. Theo is CEO of Cardano Risk Management and has got a lot of interesting things to tell us. But before we hear the bulk of what he has to say, we'll be hearing from Koos Bender. I hope I've got that right. Koos is Professor of Asset Liability Management at the Free University in Amsterdam and the Director of Ortec, and he will talk to us about risk management aspects for pension funds as well. Theo, perhaps I can hand over to you to introduce things.
I'm not sure if this one works. Okay. Well, thank you for inviting us, Colin, here in the famous Stable Inn. Well, I hope we can add something to the discussion today. Maybe I should explain a little bit how I came to the book and to the topic. So I came from the investment banking environment in the 90s. I went to the pension industry, and I was really a little bit flabbergasted about what happened when I saw that people were looking at pensions as something like, well, do we get enough return, etc. And in my opinion, the pensions were something like, it's a whole accumulation of options which are written and received between various people in the system, and nobody's ever valuing these options. So the first year when we started Cardano in 2000, we had a seminar, it was actually in 2001, and we introduced this topic in the Netherlands and received a lot of attention at that point, but it was just for fun, because it was in fact the whole book was just for fun, because nobody at that moment was really actually using it, and there was not that much of tension visible in the pension system as it is now. Well, since then, since 2001, a lot of things happened, of course, in equity markets and interest rates, etc., new regulations. And I think the pension system has come under a lot of pressure, both in the Netherlands and in the UK. And so that's maybe now a much hotter topic than it was then, to make sure or to make transparent what all the value of the embedded options is and what the distribution of wealth is between employers, employees and retirees in pension systems. So that's the main part of the book, and that's what I will want to discuss tonight. And I do it in a dual presentation with Guus, because Guus and I work together a lot, and we do a lot of things together. We don't do everything together, fortunately. But we do presentations together, and Guus will do his presentation will be an introduction to more what kind of tensions do we have in the pension system, and where should we, in more broad lines, focus on the next few years? What are the real topics, and maybe the gap between what we're focusing on today and what we should focus on in the future? And then I will explain something about the embedded options in my book, and what I think that the pension system, if there would be a collective pension system in the future, how that should look like to be sustainable. So I think this is now up to Husen. And I'm sorry for our accent. Well, I have a funny accent, but Husen probably just as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for being here. Two very small Dutch guys. I'm not very large. Theo is even shorter. This presentation is for two reasons very difficult for me. I will explain you why. First of all, as Theo already mentioned, I'm going to talk more about problems than about solutions. And Theo is going to talk more about the solutions, so there's 1-0 ahead for him. And secondly, that's even more difficult for me. I should be short, because most of the time should be devoted to the embedded option approach for pension reform, and I'm not very famous in the Netherlands and other countries about being short. But I will try. As I mentioned, and Theo already a little bit mentioned, I want to address two main issues in the pension industry, not only in the Dutch pension industry, but the pension industry worldwide. The first thing, which I need not explain, I think, to actually, is the issue of maturity and the resulting move worldwide as a result of maturity of pension funds to defined contribution. A few slides about that. And the second thing is that even in the Netherlands, the chairman pleasantly said that the Dutch people have the most famous pension system in the world. Maybe everybody in the world thinks so about that, but not the Dutch people themselves. So many pension deals also in the Netherlands are, in my opinion, rather wrong. Theo can say a lot more about it than I can, and he will also talk about the solutions. But I also want to address the issue about flaws in the pension deals of pension funds worldwide. And of course then a little bit about what to remedy these things, but that will more be the subject of Theo's presentation than mine. What is now happening with the... It's not my phone now. Before I go to these problems, I want to show you I'm an asset liability management person, which is the last 20 years went into my genes, being an asset liability management person. How asset liability people approach the problem of strategic decision making of pension funds. And what you see on this slide, that is on the left hand side, is even an abbreviation of what is on the rest of the slide. You should know that my background is operations research, so I want to put everything in models. I look first of all at the policy instruments of pension funds, the uncertainty by which they are confronted, and thirdly, the risk return profile, which is the result of the policy measures on the one hand and the uncertainties in the external world on the other hand, how these work out for the risk and returns of the various stakeholders of the pension fund. And what you see in this slide, that is typically of how we as asset liability people, what we sometimes call holistic asset liability management, how we approach pension fund decision making. I will not go through all the blocks on the slide, but summarized what we do, that is, first of all, we do look at all the stakeholders, the active people, the pensioners and the sponsor. And also, it is very important, we also look to the buffers and surpluses and deficits. Why? A buffer of a pension fund or a deficit of a pension fund is nothing else than transferring the risk of contributions and indexations to future people. So also the future people are stakeholder in the pension fund through either buffers or deficits.
So first of all, we look at all the stakeholders of the pension fund, and secondly, we also look at all the policy instruments available. So many asset liability people all over the world focus too much only on the strategic asset allocation, what they say, given the liabilities. We think that is wrong in the sense that you leave the other instruments unused, also take into account not only strategic asset allocation as a decision measure for pension fund, but also the contribution policy and also the indexation policy. And here is then the same slide, but in a new jacket. This is the same slide in terms of what in these days is called then risk budgets. Actually, what asset liability people try to achieve, and in many cases that is one of the problems we are not able to do so until the very end, that is that what asset liability projects try to achieve, that is that we try to achieve, for example, for the active people, how much pension risk do they have, and how much sponsor risk do they have if the active people also pay contributions. For the non-actives, let's say the pensioners, of course, they have pension risk in terms of conditional indexation. The sponsor has sponsor risk, and again, we have the risk which is allocated to the future members in terms of possible deficit. The most important result of an asset liability project is that at the end of the project, you know how much risk do we allocate to the active people, the employees, how much risk do we allocate to the pensioners, how much risk do we allocate to the sponsor, and how much risk do we allocate to the future generations by allowed probability of deficits. And what should be the case, it is maybe a little bit abstract, but what should be the case, that is that all the risk that you allocate, the risk that you allocate to all the stakeholders, the active people, the pensioners, etc., that should add up or be in correspondence with the risk in the strategic asset allocation, because if that is not the case, something is wrong. Because either you take too little risk, and too little risk is costly because then you will make too little return. In most cases, that is one of my issues on the later slides, many pension funds take too much risk in the sense that the risk which is in the strategic asset allocation is not accounted for by the risk budgets of the either the active people or the pensioners or the sponsor or the future generations. I will come to that later. So my first main issue. Frequently, if you read papers about pension reform, then these papers start that we need pension reform, for example, due to the fact that interest rates have dropped or that equity markets have dropped. In my opinion, that's almost irrelevant with respect to the necessity of pension reform. Also, very frequently you hear that we need pension reform due to IFRS, due to the accounting measures. In my opinion, that is also not the case. It should be very strange if accounting rules would be responsible for changing the pension system. I'm not very fond of the accounting rules, by the way, but one advantage of the accounting rules is, in the first place, that they make transparent the things which are going on in the pension fund. So these things are not the reason for pension reform. I'm convinced that the only main reason for pension reform, with the exception of what you are going to mention of possible tensions within generations, that is the maturity of pension funds. And maybe everybody in the UK knows already these very simple examples, but in the Netherlands it was the case, and that is not typically Dutch, but only the timing is typically Dutch, that if you would look at the pension fund in the 80s, then, for example, 10% of the liabilities, I forgot to translate BBP, that stands for gross domestic product, but then in Dutch. In the 80s, 10% of the liabilities of the pension funds was about equal to 2% of gross domestic product. Now it is about equal, maybe even a little bit more, that the liabilities in the pension funds are about equal to gross domestic product of our whole country. You are a little behind, but not a lot in the UK. So in the UK, if you round it up to 100 numbers, it is the same. And that makes it already impossible, the situation of today, to be able that all the risk is in which is in the pension fund, that if things go wrong, that the employees and the companies are able to cope with that. Because if you would have a 10% deficit, that would be 10% of gross domestic product, and it is completely impossible that a 10% deficit in the pension fund should be at the detriment of 10% loss of gross domestic product. That's already completely impossible. And at the top point of aging, which in our country is in about 2030, then 10% of the liabilities in the pension fund will be about 25% of gross domestic product. So then it becomes impossible that the economy, to put it a little bit strange, that the economy is able to carry all the risk in their pension fund. That's simply impossible. So for that reason, in the Netherlands, we already changed from defined benefit scheme to conditionally indexed schemes. And on one of my next slides, it says that even that is not enough, and we are going to so-called collective defined contribution schemes. Here in the UK, there are still many defined benefit schemes going on, and I do think, although I'm very much in favor of these schemes, if possible, of course, but I'm convinced that the maturity issue, and especially the risk aspect of the maturity issue, makes it in many cases impossible to continue these defined benefit schemes, and that is not typically Dutch, that's not typically UK. This holds for every pension fund. If it starts, if you look at it, let's say 30 years later, it is in this situation. So what happened then in many countries, skipping the first point, due to time reasons, what happens then in many countries, that is that people try to stay as long as possible to defined benefit schemes, and if that is completely impossible, for example if things went wrong, then they immediately move completely to the other side of the pension scheme range, from defined benefit to individual defined contribution. Last week I had a conversation with one of the large actuarial companies, or the head of one of the large actuarial companies in the Netherlands, and he said, well, we withdraw from Australia. He said, why did you withdraw from Australia? Well, he said, there the pension funds all completely transferred to defined contribution, and defined contribution, then every person is a pension fund. So that was not very interesting for this actuarial company. So that is an example that in many cases what happens, people try to keep up a defined benefit scheme too long, and if things then go wrong, they completely move to the other side of the spectrum, which is individual defined contribution. We Dutch people, we are not very much in favor of individual defined contributions. Skipping the first point, I'm going to this point over here. These people, Manel and Munden, they wrote a book, they are US people, they wrote a book about 401k plans in the US. Thank you.
And Dutch people are very fond of these two women because they wrote a book that individual defined contribution works out dramatically with an enormous amount of data, how it worked out dramatically for individuals in the US. There is also the research of the Dutch Central Bank, and that simply says that all the decisions that the trustees of pension funds have to make, which are getting more difficult every day, they have to know, they have to read, for example, all the book of Theo, which I did, and it is not very easy to read, I can tell you. And in individual defined contribution, every person is responsible for the same kind of decision that now a board of trustees of a pension fund is. That's completely impossible. In the book of Manel and Munden are crazy examples, crazy real-life examples, how people do wrong with respect to strategic asset allocation in individual defined contribution. Young people being completely in fixed income, old people being completely in equity and vice versa. Very strange developments. What is also in the book in defined contribution in the US, if it is, for example, the case that if you put 5% in your own pension fund, and if then the sponsor also would add 5%, that nevertheless many people do not put the 5% in the pension fund, even if the sponsor would double that, due to the fact that the time value of money is so important for people, I do think especially for US people. So many things go wrong, and a person who is, we in the Netherlands think that he is worldwide famous due to the fact that he was born in the Netherlands, Kees Ambachseer, of SEM, I do think that many people here know him as well. He figured out that in individual defined contribution, people make 3% less return per year than the return in professionally managed pension funds. And suppose that 3% return would be a good guess for the equity risk premium, then it is the case that those people, those individual defined contribution people, have the risk of a fully equity portfolio and the income of a fully fixed income portfolio, and you can guess where the difference stays. I will skip that one and also go to, because this is enough, that defined contribution is not a good solution. What surprised me a little, that is that a research of the Dutch Central Bank in the year 2006 They did a very large research in the Netherlands, and it appeared that people not only are able to take those individual decisions for their own pension schemes in this in the defined contribution, but that they also are not willing to do so. They want other people to take that decision, so people don't trust themselves with respect to the decision that they make with respect to their pensions. So the individual defined contribution, maybe now the UK, if you are going to move, do not move to defined contribution. So what happened in the Netherlands and also more and more in other countries in the world, that is that the move that we made from defined benefit to conditionally indexed pensions. So for example, ABP and PGGM, two pension funds of about 200 billion at about, let's say, 80 or 100 billion. They move from defined benefit to conditionally indexed pension schemes, and that means that the indexation of the pension rights of the people, actives and non-actives, is dependent on the funded ratio of the pension fund. So if the funded ratio is below 100, they do not index at all. If the funded ratio is somewhere between 100 and 130, they index partly, and above 130, given nominal interest rates, by the way, they fully index. That is called conditional indexation, only indexing if the pension fund has enough buffers, and if not, either partly or not. For many Dutch pension funds, that measure, which made the pension funds much more strong from a risk management point of view, was not enough, and now collective defined contribution is a kind of a hype in the Netherlands. And by hype, I do mean that many funds move to collective defined contribution. And I use the word hype, and also meaning by that, that it is also wrong aspects. In the following sense, so in the collective defined contribution, the contribution is fixed. So for many multinationals like DSM, for example, and AXO, they have a collective defined contribution, which means a fixed contribution for the sponsor. And then the rest of the pension fund works like a conditionally indexed pension scheme, but with a fixed contribution. And there are some problems with that, that's maybe the English way to put it. I should say in the Dutch way, there are many important problems with that. How to make these arrangements in these collective defined contribution schemes? First of all, it should be clearly defined how the rules are with respect to who gets what in which good situation and who gets not what in which bad situation. Then the second thing is, of course, given the amount of risk that people are willing and able to take in those pension funds, to exploit that risk as good as possible to make the maximum return in order to make as good as possible pension. And the third point, of course, these things should be efficiently monitored and managed. Now my first bridge to the PhD thesis of Theo. Where do derivatives come in? They come in two ways. And the first way, that's the most important way, and that is actually the topic of his PhD thesis. That is the use of that theory to create fair contracts. You have to explain that later. But Theo will explain how the embedded options theory can be used to value what people put in the pension fund, and that should also be the basis of what they get out, in order to help you a little bit already. The second thing which is very important and which is not used enough yet in our country, and I do think in other countries as well, and that is actually the reason that we have the company like Cardano in the Netherlands. That is, until the company like Cardano started in the Netherlands, in many occasions when we tried to satisfy these solvency constraints, we used only equity classes and fixed income classes, and maybe real estate, etc. And then I explained it also always as follows to my students and also to the trustees. Then we tried to move the wheel of assets of equity and fixed income until we hit the point that the probability of underfunding was, let's say, 5% or 1% or whatever. And you can imagine that you can do that much more efficiently if you want to satisfy a probability constraint like 1% or 5% probability of underfunding. You can imagine that you can do that much more efficiently if you use derivatives rather than only changing the strategic asset allocation over equity and fixed income. It seems so trivial and so important, but nevertheless, too few clients use derivatives either for strategic purposes like point A, but also for creating as efficiently possible portfolios which create the maximum return on the one hand and in the most efficient way satisfy the probability constraints on the other hand. And I will skip the part about risk management. You will have to take that part. The second problem. There is one small difference in this slide, and that small difference is over here. That is, although as a liability people are now already for 25 years doing asset liability management in the Netherlands and also more and more in other countries, it is still the case that in many cases the most important decision, being that you specify the risk limits of each of the stakeholders on the one hand, and that the risk which the pension fund is taking in the strategic asset allocation is in correspondence with the risk that the people really bear, this correspondence is in many cases not there. So actually then the asset liability people should be fired, because that is the most important thing that they should accomplish. That is that the risks are defined, and that the risk that the pension fund is taking is in accordance with the risk limits of each of the stakeholders in the pension fund. I see many people nodding, which pleases me a lot. But nevertheless, if you would be a trustee, I would have a difficult problem in order to convince you to create a pension deal in such a way that it is clear who bears the risk, and is the risk in the strategic asset allocation in accordance of all the risks of the risk of all the stakeholders. That's a very, very difficult issue. Some large pension funds, and I will not tell too much about it because they are very good clients and also some of them very good friends. But they even say in public that they do not have yet complete pension deals. And what I mean to say by that they do not have complete pension deals yet, that's exactly this problem. The problem then is that they know that the amount of risk in the strategic asset allocation is not in accordance with the risks that the people really are able or willing to bear. This is an example. This is not art, by the way. What you see over here, this is my last slide but one. What you see over here, that is the result of a so-called conditionally indexed pension scheme. I try to explain to you that Dutch pension funds at high funded ratio, they give full indexations. At the funded ratio below 100, they do not index at all. By the way, because they are not allowed to do so by the Dutch Central Bank. And if the funded ratio is between something like 130 and 100, they proportionally index. At 100, 0, at 100, and 130, 100%. So that means that what we call then the purchasing power, and the purchasing power, that is the percentage that the pension is of the full index pension, then there is a risk that the purchasing power is not 100, because in some cases the pension fund will not fully index. And here you see a result of such a liability project, where each of the yellow lines is then the scenario development, which is the consequences of the ALM policy and the external uncertainties. The blue line is one of the 500, so you see that for in this future development, the purchasing power drops to, let's say, 93 or something like that. It moves up again due to the fact that many pension funds have so-called recovery schemes. They even get to 100, but after 25 years it is again about at the point of about 92. Now, two important things to remark. The first thing is, although ABP and PGGM and many other pension funds have such a pension scheme, so their participants have the risk on this slide, if you would do a research and ask the people, are you aware that you do have this risk, I do think that 90% of the people would say that they are not aware at all about the risk which they are bearing. And the second thing, and that is the second bridge also to the presentation of Theo, this was introduced 2 to 3 years ago. So a lot of the risk of the pension fund was transferred to the participants. And what do they get back in return? You can see it on this slide, nothing. So they got this risk due to the fact that we went to conditional indexation, and there is no reward in that for them at all. So what should happen, that is, people should compute this amount of risk, like you, and then it should be the case that these pensions in expectation should get a higher pension than 100, so that the amount of risk that they are taking is properly rewarded. I've told that this is not secret at all, so if you go to the Netherlands, you can tell it to these clients as well. But although I have told this in many cases, for example, I wrote this in the farewell book of the CIO of ABP, Jean Freins, who was the other supervisor of Theo's thesis. And this is also the case for ABP. And I, in my paper, in his goodbye book, I wrote down this. And I said, the pension deal of ABP is wrong. So I asked the people of ABP, because I wanted to be friendly, to this pension fund on this occasion, and also in all other occasions. So I asked them, would you consider it unpleasant if I write it down that there is a flaw in your pension scheme? And they said, we don't care at all, write it down. But that was about 2 years ago, and the problem is still there. What I was going to say, but due to time reasons I could skip that, that is that we on the continent are sometimes a little bit surprised by the amount of equity in the UK pension funds. And to put it, to say it in an English way, so not in a confronting Dutch way, it could be the case, maybe, that for many UK pension funds, this equal sign is a very large unequal sign, in the sense that the risk in your portfolios, which you need of course for the return, maybe does not correspond with the amount of risk that all the stakeholders in your pension funds are willing to take. And if that is the case, and it holds also for many of my clients, then there is a fundamental mistake in your system. I could say it as well, also in the following way, because we know that you English people, you are bettors. I would make a bet with each of you that this is in a large extent the case also in your country. And then you could change that, of course, and use Theo's PhD for that, because what I'm saying over here is actually a replication of what I said with respect to collective defined contribution. If this is not right, so if the risk in your pension funds in the strategic asset allocation does not correspond with the risk that the stakeholders are willing to bear, you should do something about it. And you should do either something with respect to the strategic asset allocation, which would be a pity, because then you would lose the return. So then you should do something in the pension scheme itself. And that's the second base to Theo's thesis. The approach in his thesis can help with that. It's the same as here. So it is useful. This approach is very useful to approach these kinds of problems. And of course, it is also very useful that given the amount of risk that you're able to take in your strategic asset allocation, that you also use derivatives to do that as efficiently as possible. Now, Theo, it's up to you. Are there still questions or questions later?
I think you can take questions at the end.
Yes. I saw many questioning eyes. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, Guus, for the introduction and for making transparent what kind of problems there are, so that helps me a little bit with my presentation. The name of my presentation is, especially about, with respect to my book, it's chapter 5. It's how the pension systems are gradually moving from what used to be a terms of employment, simple employer thing, to in the future, in 2010 or 2030, there will be no or not many employer-based pension funds anymore, I expect, for the reasons I explained in my book. And there will be a pension system will gradually move into something like a life cycle saving plan. It's more a saving plan than an employer secondary condition for your contract with your employer. Well, many things are written down in the book. I can only touch upon a few things tonight. So that's, of course, always the problem if you have a brief, concise presentation. I'd like to concentrate on the following things. First of all, give a little bit of an explanation what I mean with embedded options in the pension fund. Not much about the techniques, only a few words. Then what is changing and why, briefly, more in a qualitative manner than a quantitative. I will use some of the numbers in my book. And what I think, what would make sense as a collective savings system. So if we would end up with a savings system that is still some kind of a collective pension fund, how should it look like? Well, a pension fund, what I said, is, in my opinion, nothing more than a saving plan, an individual saving plan, but then combined with a lot of options written by employers, written by some of the active people, some of the retirees in a pension fund. I give some examples. For example, there is something like a guarantee by the employer. If there's a shortfall in the pension fund, then he will, up to a certain extent, pay into the pension fund. That's what I call the employer's guarantee. But then again, there are many other options. For example, there is in the UK, you have a cap on the indexation you receive. So if the inflation is 10%, you only get 5% or 2.5%, depending on exactly what kind of system you're in and what time you receive that liability. But, for example, when we look at the, and I made some examples about the PBGC, the Pension Guarantee Fund in the US, if many of the 25% of all the pension funds which are in a deficit in the US, they should all be restored, repaid by the employers. But what happened is 25% of those companies defaulted. And suddenly they just put the pension fund into an empty pot, which they called the PBGC, which had 6 billion money in it, and they have 100 billion deficit. So that's one of those tricks. And it's much easier in the US, of course. You default on your company, you put your pension fund somewhere else, and then you restart the next day. That's only just like rebuying a cup of coffee. It's probably more difficult in the UK and in the Netherlands, but it's a very important thing that what it says is the credit rating of a company is also determining the value of the option that, for example, employers, employees and the retirees have on the pension fund. If there's a deficit, then you write an option that you will have to pay the deficit if the company defaults. So I made all kind of calculations how you what the value of these options is in terms of percentage of the liabilities. And for example, what Guus already mentioned, in Holland we have the indexation option. That means that if there's any deficit in the pension fund, your indexation will be either waived or you will not receive it for several years in a row, or you will get it back if the pension the funding ratio is restored. These are very complex options. In this case it's kind of a digital option. It is either you get all indexation or nothing, or sometimes you get part of the indexation. What's very important about these claims is they are very substantial. So they are not 2% or 5%, but they are 20, 30, 40% of the total of liabilities. So when you look at the figures, that the pension liabilities are equal to the gross domestic product in both in the UK and in the Netherlands. Then it means if you have 30 or 40% of value of these options, that's 40% of the gross domestic product. So to me it's quite strange that we never had much attention on these figures. And only the last few years there is more attention also from academics on valuing these options. Well, what's happening now? The techniques applied. I applied just the plain vanilla option pricing techniques. Well, they're not very plain vanilla, but at least they are used already for 30 years and they are advancing every year with new techniques, but it's, in fact, it's nothing new. And for talking to the actuaries, I think actuaries have implemented what they call the deflator approach. And for those of you who are familiar with the deflator approach or the kernel theories, these theories are in effect come to the same value. So the valuation is the principles are exactly the same and the outcome are exactly the same. I just mentioned this because of the familiarity with deflator methodologies. Bottom line is, you could, if you have this option, if you could buy it in the market, and we do a lot of transactions with investment banks, they could offer these products. If pension funds would be very stable organizations who don't change their asset allocation, etc., then they would be able to provide these options and then price them and sell them in the market. So it's not a technique which you can dispute. You can dispute maybe if it's 39% or 41%, but not if it's 5% or 40%. So the numbers are quite objective. So, coming back to the innovation in my book, is it a real innovation? It's nothing more than using old techniques but applying them to a pension system. So the only innovation is in making the embedded options transparent and making some suggestions for redesigning pension funds. My example is, I want to explain something about what changed during the last two or three decades in the pension world and what will change. And I will do that by means of a balance sheet. I think we're all familiar with balance sheets. You have assets on the one side and liabilities on the other side. On the asset side, in the pension fund, you have investments. On the liability side, usually the only thing you will see is liabilities of the retirees, so that the pension rights and the pension rights of the active members that they are accumulating in the accumulation phase. And then you have a surplus, and the surplus doesn't have any ownership, so nobody owns the surplus, which is quite different from, for example, a corporate, where they have equity holders and the equity owns the surplus of a corporate. So you have assets, you subtract the debt, and then what's left is equity for the equity holders. In the pension fund, it's slightly different. In the past, the employer gave the employers a guarantee to the pension fund, let's say 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And you would have some surplus, or you would have a deficit. If there was a deficit, he would pay to the pension fund. It would be relatively simple because the amounts were much smaller. Like you showed, there was only a 1 in 5 relation between the gross domestic product and the pension size, and now it's 1 to 1, and it will be 2.5 to 1, so it will increase dramatically. So the only thing he had to do is to pay some more contribution rates or restore the deficits. And on the other hand, if things went very well, then that was good, because most of the equity, the surplus, was not literally defined as being to the ownership of the employer, but he could take some restitutions. At least it happened in Holland, or he could reduce his contribution rates to zero, the contribution holidays, and gradually he would get the equity out of the company back to his corporate. So he took the risk and he took the return. What happened? The maturing of the pension fund has been discussed by Kuus. Pension funds have been maturing. There is an aging society which production shifts to Eastern Europe and China, etc. We see a shift in the maturity of pension funds, which is accelerating at the moment. That means that the contribution rate policy don't work anymore. They don't work like they used to work. If you pay 5 or 10% more contributions, it will not help a lot, if anything, for restoring your deficits. And on the other hand, there was also fair value accounting, which is, as Kuus mentioned, it's only the messenger. The fair value accounting methodology, FRS 17 in the UK, was only there to make transparent that there are more risks in the pension fund than there was assumed in the past. But for an employer, that means that in the past he had little downside, because due to the accounting he could smooth the results if things went bad. And if things went very good with the return, he could take some money back with restitutions, contribution rate holidays. So what I call a position where the downside is to the left is relatively small and the upside is large. This is very stylized, it's not the real fact. But what happened now is a situation where you have much downside. If things go wrong, you have to put everything on the balance sheet, for a corporate, for example. And if things go right, there's much tougher rules. For example, in Holland, the rules to restitution are almost, so strict that you cannot expect any restitution anymore from a pension fund to a corporate. So there's less upside, you cannot get anything out of the surplus, and you have a lot of downside. And what's the implication? Well, in option terms, we call it, you went from, in the past, increasing volatility in a pension fund was good. More risk meant more value for the firm. And now we are in a situation that more risks means less value. In option terms, you went from a long vega to a short vega position, but that's more a technical term. But the only implication is there is literally a very rational reason for employers to reduce risk, to shy away from pension funds, which actually happened in the UK, and it's the same is happening in Holland. But in Holland, people are denying it still. At least many pension funds are denying the increasing risks. So probably we have to wait either till the same thing as here in the UK happens, that suddenly there's a shift from employer risk-taking to no employer risk-taking anymore, closing defined pension benefit pension funds. Or what my proposition would be, we reshape and redesign the pension system into something like a collective DC, as Chris was mentioning, but then with fair rules. Bottom line is, gradually over the years, the employers have shifted part of their risk to the employees and to the retirees. They have done it via indexation, conditional indexation, or caps on indexation, etc. Also via the options I mentioned, the default option and other kind of constructions where the employers or the employees have to take part of the risk. For example, at BAE, I saw a few weeks ago, that they also have put the longevity risk from the employer to the employees in the pension system. So that's already one step further. Gradually, it's a very logical process. The employers cannot bear all these risks anymore, and they shy away from risk more and more. So now we have two parties in taking the risk, or three, in fact. You have the employees, the retirees, and the employers. And now the question is, who owns the equity? Who owns the? If there would be a surplus, how would you divide that surplus? And what I did in chapter 3 of the book is that I valued the options that they are writing to the pension fund. And I said, well, if you write, for example, if you take the 100% funding ratio, so the funding ratio goes from 70 to 130, if you take it 100%, the parent guarantee is worth 17.8% of the liability value, so let's say 20. And the other pension put that the employees and the retirees write, and the indexation option, so the conditional indexation is, for example, in this case, 14.4%. So the risk, the value of the risk that the parent company has put into the system is 55%. So you could argue, well, that's the money. They have written these options. They didn't put money in the system, but they put options in the system. So that's their equity. That's the money, the equity they have put into the pension fund. 55% for the parent, 45% for the employees and the retirees. And you can argue, well, at different parameters, for example, at a high funding ratio, the share of the parent is lower. At a very low funding ratio, he has to take more risk because the parent guarantee will explode, it will be very high, and he will have a 72% share. So that's only hypothetical. And I call it interesting question, but a little too late. Well, that's because the employers are not taking these risks anymore, or not accepting them. Probably they should have done this exercise before and then see how they could share, take a fair share. Because in Holland, when the employers in the past took money out of the pension fund, the headlines in the newspapers was that they were grabbing out of the pension fund. And I don't see why you can call it grabbing if they took 72% of the risk, for example. So nobody made an exercise about what the risk was that they took and what the value of that risk was. But when they took something back, they call it stealing from the pension fund or whatever headlines they were used. And that's probably because if you're ignorant about the real risk and the real value, then you get all these conflicts. Well, I also made some examples about the rating of the parent company. If the parent company has a very high rating, it's very likely that he will pay on his parent guarantee. And he has a higher share in the pension fund. For example, with a very low rating, it's not worth anything at all. An airliner in the U.S. who promises a pension is worth nothing. I think, well, we now understand what that means. This is a summary, which is also in the book. So the employer's ownership ranges from 80% if he has a very high credit rating and a high volatile pension fund, to, for example, only 8% in case of a very low credit rating. And so it can range dramatically depending on if you're a Shell pension fund or a BA pension fund, for example. So the employers will retreat. They will not exist as risk takers. In Holland, what they did is they went to collective DC. They said, well, we don't want to pay 20% or 30% contribution rates, and that can be 10% and 40%, and it fluctuates every year. We want to pay a fixed amount. And what was quite fair in Holland is that when they went to collective DC, at least they paid a very high amount of contribution rates. For example, 25% or 30% contributions to the pension fund. I think Huus right, those collective DC, wherein the risk was transferred to the employees and the retirees, but at least they paid, they take the risk in the future, but they get a very fair 25% annual contribution rate in the pension fund, which is quite different from what happened in the UK, where the employer shifted from DB to DC, and by shying away from the risk, taking the risk to the other people, they reduced the contribution rates, as I read in all the magazines and the papers, from 12% to 6%. So I don't know what happened and why people accepted it in the UK, but apparently it was accepted. That's one of the most flabbergasting things that I have seen in the pension world and in my life. So another solution is not shifting to individual DC, but to collective DC, and that's something I want to discuss for a few minutes. In a collective DC, you get a very interesting thing. You get, in fact, you have something like a saving plan. It's not an employer's plan anymore, it's a saving plan. But with people saving in that pension fund, and if things go wrong, then you have to cut on your indexation, maybe you have to cut on your pension rights, because if things go, for example, the funding ratio goes to 70 or 60, you have to write off part of your liabilities probably. And who is writing off what? Well, I think that the active retirees in the collective DC, they will get their, of course, because they get it now. There are a lot of underfunded pension funds in Holland, and the retirees get their pension, so they day by day they get their pension. But if it's underfunded, that means that the actives, the ones who's the last in the row, is bearing most of the risks, because he will be the last one to put out the light, and either he receives maybe 5 billion, or he gets nothing. But the point is, there's nothing written down on who gets what if things go well, and there's nothing written down who gets what if things go wrong. Only that temporary, for the time being, we cut the indexation, for example. So you have an equity, a surplus, a possible surplus, which is not defined. And you have probably a guarantee from the actives to the retirees. So the younger people, that's why at my book, the older people are still laughing, because they are on the top of the pyramid, and the people who are in it's a pyramid game. Gradually, the aging, all aging game is something like a pyramid game, and the younger people are paying then. They're paying all the risks, and these risks are worth something between 20% and 50% of the total liability. So every pound you put in the pension system, 50 cents is gone, because it's an option you write to the retirees. In, for example, in very volatile pension funds. In Holland, that example, the very volatile pension funds, there was, well, that's only a joke. Well, who has a 15% volatility, 15 or 20? Then you need 80% equity in a pension fund. That's impossible. Well, now I'm in the UK, so I can tell you that that's something that happens quite often here. So that means that people are writing huge risks from one, either the employer or the actors are taking these risks in the pension fund. And I think the actors are taking these risks, because the employer are already, either they have already retreated, or they, and if really, if the shit hits the fan, then the employers will try to get rid of the pension fund one way or another. So the actors are the ones, I assume, who are taking the risk. But that's something where you can argue about. I made that assumption, and then I started to calculate all the figures. Now my point would be, there's nothing wrong with taking the risk. Actors are the ones who should take the risk. So if the actors, you know, they have still 20, 30 years, and probably 40 years, because in the near future we will work till 75. There will be a lot of strikes till everybody accepts that. But in the end, everybody has to work longer. And, well, the actors have more than enough time. I mean, they can, for example, if there's a deficit, they can take 2-3% more annually in their pension fund. And that's more than enough to let's say, make the pension fund revive in the future. But if that happens, and if things go well, if they took all the risks, why don't they get the reward then? So I think in the collective system, where you still have retirees and actors in the same system sharing the risks, the retirees get a pension, and the pension is senior debt, if you take it in the balance sheet terms. They get the debt for the long term, that they are senior holders of bonds who are repaid with a very high probability. The actors have the equity, and because they have the equity, they take the risk, just like every equity holder has the risk of the company, the first risk, but they also have the first right on a surplus. They own the surplus. So what that means in practice is that in the pension fund, and probably in between will be a group which I call, in balance sheet terms, subordinated rights. There are some older actors who are close to retirement. They don't want to take all the risks that the younger actors take, so they get something like a corridor where they move in between. And that's something there where you can make some gradual shift from high risk taking to lower risk taking in a pension fund. And then at least you know that when things go very well, you know exactly who will get what amount of money and under what conditions. And that will make it a very sustainable system, where if I would be inactive now in a pension fund, in a collective DC, I would do everything to get rid of that system. Or even if I would be active in the DB in the UK, where you know that the employer will, unless it's a AAA company or something, but for many DBs it's very unlikely that if the things go very bad, that the employer can even pay up to his obligations. So if I would be active, I would be very unhappy to put money into a pension system if I don't have the exact contract rights, both the downside and the upside. And maybe one question is, like Keith Ambachs here is always telling you, this system is good, but you should make it two funds. One is the active fund, and one is, you should separate it, not in one collective system, but first the active fund, which saves the money for his retirement and then takes all the risk, and then only after that you move suddenly to a new fund, the retirement fund, where you have all the annuities. The reason why that's not very feasible, in my opinion, why you still need a collective system, is because the inflation indexation, so indexation linked to CPI or whatever, is not available in the market. So you cannot, for 1,000 billion, like in both in Holland and in the UK, you cannot buy these products for those amounts. So the reasons why you should have a collective system, in my opinion, one of the big advantages why you should keep that system is to provide inflation-indexed pensions in the future. And the basis risk, the risk, because you cannot hedge it properly, you have to take some risk in your system, can be assumed by the younger generations. And when they get older, they get the inflation-indexed pensions in their turn. So I think that was it. Now we have some time for questions, I think.
Thank you very much, both of you. So we have now about half an hour to have questions and discussions with both our speakers. And after that, there will be refreshments at the back of the hall for those who are able to stay and maybe continue the discussion then. I'd like to exercise the chairman's prerogative of asking the first question here. And I guess you could both like to answer.
As I understood it, what you're saying is that with increasing maturity, with increasing longevity, the amount of risk that there is to be borne, if you like, is too much to be taken by the sponsors.
I think I heard you saying maybe that the actives can take the whole of that risk,
but maybe when you said that with relation to GDP, maybe there's so much risk that actually the retirees themselves must take some of that risk. They don't want to take the risk in terms of potential variation to their income. So the only other way is in terms of when they can retire. It's a question, I suppose, of seeing what's the quantum here of overall risk. Who can actually bear it?
That's the most difficult question of the day.
It's the first question.
Maybe Theo, maybe you want to react first.
Yep.
Because actually, what he is saying, what you are saying, what I am saying, is inconsistent. That was his question.
I will say something, and then you can say, well, that's exactly what I wanted to say. I think that by growing more mature, the pension funds cannot take the risk that they did in the past. You cannot take, for example, with 20% active in the pension fund, take 80% equity allocation and assume those risks if there is no employer anymore. So the risks in a maturing pension fund, the risk will gradually reduce anyway, so the total risk. Total amount, and the only risk you should bear is the risk for, let's say, the actives to build up a reasonable pension for reasonable costs, and the risk of indexation, because you cannot hedge properly in the market the fully indexed pensions. So I think the risk of the pension fund themselves will go down, so the total risk. That will be a difference with the past. It's quite normal if you have a pension fund which is very immature, let's say in the 70s or in the 80s, that you have an allocation of 80% to equity. But it's very different if you have 80 or 90% of the value is linked to the retirees' liabilities. Then it's very illogical to have those allocations. So the total risk will reduce, I'm quite sure. And then the actors will take, as I gave some examples in my book, that the retirees can also take part of the risk, for example, by having some of the indexation cuts, and then they get also part of the upside. But then you have to define, for example, up to 5 or 10% of the liability value can be written off, but they can also have the same amount as an upside if things go very well. So you can shift the risk between the participants, and they should agree who wants to take what part of the risk. Although I think it's more logical that the younger actives take most of the risk, and then the older actives take part of the smaller part of the risk, and the retirees take hardly any risk anymore, because they just need the money for food and everything. Although I think in Holland, the 65 plus people are the richest people in Holland at the moment. So I don't think that there's a big problem if they would assume part of the risk. I'm not sure if it's the same here, by the way.
Well, I can give a very quick addition to that. I completely agree with the approach that the younger people should take most of the risk, because they have the human capital to react if things go wrong. But if you look at an average pension fund and you look what the percentage of the liabilities which is, let's say, owned by the retirees, actuaries know that that extent can be very large. So I do not think that this idea can be carried out up to the very end, that all the risk is for the young people and no risk for the other people. So I do think that it is necessary that the older people also carry some risk. And what Theo said is also true. In the Netherlands, the older people are the richest people. They are also able to carry some risk. But whether they would be able or not be able, it is only possible if they carry some risk. This is my opinion.
Thank you.
It's a very, very smart question, by the way.
Great. So just behind Con for this first. Mark.
Hi, Yali Abrampool. Obviously a very timely paper, I think, in terms of the discussion of the allocation of risk between different participants in the pension contract. but I had I wasn't convinced, and I have a theoretical point and an empirical point. I think theoretically you haven't taken inflation into the picture. For example, in a low inflation environment, the risk is with the actives, because the retirees are drawing out the money, which retains its value in real terms, and the actives have a long time to wait, and there's the possibility that the sponsor will default. In a high inflation environment, because we have limited indexation, pensioners suffer, and actives in a final salary defined benefit pension fund benefit, because their benefits are linked to salaries which rise with inflation. And I think you didn't take that into account. Inflation is a continuum. As inflation rises, the risk goes from the actives to the pensioners, which is something you haven't taken into account. That's my theoretical point. My empirical point is that in the 1930s, we had collective defined contribution schemes. And the reason that we shift from this type of arrangement to defined benefit was inflation. And during the 1930s, there was great discussion regarding the different allocation of risk between sponsors and members, and there's different kind of guarantees that were provided both ways to provide assurance to both sides. As soon as inflation showed up, these kind of guarantees became entirely irrelevant because of inflation. And that's my comment.
Yeah. Well, I agree and disagree in the first point. I agree with if you have only a conditional indexation or an indexation cap for the retirees, but your pension rise are fully accumulated according to your salary growth, in that case the retirees bear all the inflation risk in case of high inflation. So in that case I agree. But in Holland we have also a lot of systems where you have career average indexation, and the indexation cuts are also applying to those who are still active. So if there is a low funding ratio in Holland, then the way that you calculate your liabilities is also at that moment indexation is not so the loan, the growth in the loan at that moment is not taken into account. So in that system, in that average salary system, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it here in the UK, but in that environment, both the retirees and the active suffer from a cut in indexation in a high inflation environment. And I'm not sure if you agree with that, but it's, so that depends on the structure of your pension fund and the way, if it's final salary or if it's average career salary, including conditional indexation, like we have, and that's what I applied also in my thesis. Then they that's actually happening now in Holland. They stop indexation because also for your the way you accumulate your pension rights. So it's a formula, and the formula is calculated based on your average career. Maybe Chris can add something to that.
It is since the recent years the conditional indexation until a few years ago that only applied to the non-actives. But the last reforms, especially by EBP and PGM, then conditional indexation applied both to non-actives and to actives. And if EBP and PGM do something, all the others follow.
Thank you. It's Jonathan Hoffman, National Association of Pension Funds. I find it difficult looking at your stable collective solution, your last slide, to see that is a better outcome than the system we've got at the moment. I can see why it would be a better outcome if we had a DC world, but we don't. We have a mixture of DB and DC. Now, if you take DB as we've got at the moment, the downside is with the employer. The employer has to set out a recovery plan if there's a deficit. The employer may get the upside, but that's, I think, legally slightly unclear who the surpluses belong to, but as we have people getting older and older and more schemes are closing, it becomes more and more difficult for the employer to get the surplus out of the scheme, because you can't, if you take a contribution holiday, there's not that many people contributing. So your scheme, the sponsors don't get the upside, the employee has the upside risk. The sponsors don't get the upside, the employees get the upside. The downside, the sponsors don't pay, the employee pays. So there's a tremendous risk on the employee. And the macroeconomic result, it seems to me, would simply be that people have no idea what their pension is. So they have to save more in other forms. So you sort of tip the economy into a recession. I mean, how is your system better than the system we have in the UK at the moment?
Can I answer the question?
Oh, I'm so happy with your remark. Actually, what my personal conviction is with respect to an optimal pension scheme, it should not be DB, it should not be DC, it should both be DB and DC. How I explain to my clients how the pension scheme should look like, that is that each of the stakeholders and the sponsor and the actives and the non-actives, they should take as much as possible risk, but not more than that. That also holds for the sponsor. Now, in a complete DB scheme, for many sponsors, the pension risk is so large that it could ruin the company. That is the reason that for many of my clients, I'm not in favor of complete defined benefit. I'm also not in favor of complete defined collective defined contribution. For many reasons, one of the reasons is that I want the sponsor to remain in the pension contract. Also, pensions be a very important secondary labor condition. But I also consider it important that the sponsor keeps taking risk in the pension fund and gets a proper reward for that. But pension funds should not be very happy with a sponsor who says that he is willing to take all the pension risk if in real life he is not able to take all the pension risk. So for that reason, I'm not explaining very clearly that what I do want that is that the sponsor takes the maximum amount of risk, but not more than that, and gets a good reward, and that the actors take a maximum amount of risk, but not more than they carry and get the reward, and the same for the pensioners. And as Theo said, the younger people, in contrast to the older people, have their human capital if things go wrong, that they can react. So they can take more risk than the older people. But each of the parties should take that amount of risk such that we can keep up as good as possible strategic asset allocations, get a return and give the reward to and the sponsor and the younger people and the older people. So an optimal system in my point of view should be hybrid. Not defined contribution, not complete collective defined contribution and not completely defined benefit. Maybe you could react on that?
That's the system we have. We have a system where the employee has a certain amount of confidence in what they're getting, whether it's in the defined benefit or whether it's not, because we have a pension protection fund. And the OSP, it's difficult to see that they're having.
But in your scheme, is it true that in most cases? You fully index up to a cap of about 8%. What then?
5% is.
Yeah, 5% then. That will be very difficult to sustain in all kinds of future economic developments.
So, Theo would like to add something.
Yeah. Maybe I can add something why I wrote this book. It's because I don't want the employers to be treated as a risk taker. I am 100% sure that they are preparing themselves, and that's why we talk to many pension funds in Holland.
Yeah.
All the industry-wide pension funds, for example, those are, let's say, multi-employer pension funds. They don't have any possibility anymore to increase their 25-30% contribution rate. So they have already decided within those funds that if really things happen now, like in 2002 and 2003, they have to write off the liability. So things, the risks are already in all those industry-wide pension funds. Like Sean Frein said last week, ABB is already in collective DC. The employer is not able to pay anymore. And 10, 20 years from now, they will absolutely not, the pension funds will be so huge, they will not be able. So it's not that I don't like it. I like an employer to take the risk, but they will not be able to do so. And then this is the second best example of how you could design a pension fund. So that's the reason why I wrote this book. Maybe I wrote it for a period where everybody agrees on that, and that may be 5 or 10 years from now. But that's my what I see happening in the future, and not as a current situation, I'm perfectly happy with DB. It's probably is much better than individual DC. And this is if the employer is not able anymore to take all the risks or even any risk, but then this is the second best solution and better than individual DC. That's the only reason why I designed this pension fund.
But I mean, no employers, because you said 25% of the second, no employers.
Not a lot.
Maybe that's your answer.
But most of them are paying it in Holland, and they're paying their maximum now, like 20-25%. That's it. That's the maximum. And now they cannot take any risks anymore. They pay the DC, the defined contribution, but they will not pay in Holland. They will not pay anymore. And here in the UK, maybe 12. The average was 12, I understand, or 15. Well, but there is a cap to what they can pay. So in effect, what I propose is, in the end, they cannot accept to pay 40 or 50% if they have to recoup. If their pension funds grow more and more mature, the employer will not be able to take the risk. It's not another something I would like to, but it's just a fact of life.
Yeah. Can we move on? Sorry.
Can I add one short remark very quickly? I would like to talk to you later about the hybrid scheme here. Very interested in that. And the second thing that I would like to remark, if you look at the Dutch multinationals like Unilever, Shell, etc., for these organizations, it is the case that if the pension fund would have a deficit of 10%, it would be 150% of salaries. So the leverage between these companies and the pension fund is about 15. For some it is 20, for others it is 12. Meaning that if they would have to make up a deficit of 10% in the pension fund, that would mean 150% of salaries in these organizations. And for many of them that is just too much. And the CFOs of these companies, they are very risk averse, I can tell you that.
Thank you.
They are too much risk averse in my opinion.
This actually really harps. Sorry, I'm Colin Keating. This harps back to Colin's opening point. If we look at global macroeconomic volatility, it's at its lowest level in more than 100 years. Globally, output is higher, more predictable, more stable than for more than 100 years. So the first question I would like to know is, all of this risk that you want us to be concerned with, where does it come from? The related thing, of course, is over that 100 years, everyone has been living remarkably longer, which actually says, or suggests, that increasing longevity induces stability rather than creates something that we should be panicking about. And I suppose the final part is, if one is genuinely believing that longevity is increasing in risk and in some way bad, what's the optimum age of death in that model?
This one is for you.
You should ask an actuary, maybe.
Do you have any comments, or should we go to the next?
It's actually more a remark than, yeah. Isn't it?
It's a very interesting.
It is an interesting remark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul.
Paul Riemers. These rumours about Dutch hybrid schemes started to hit our shores about a year, 2 years ago, and there is some interest here. But in the UK, we have the problem that the pensions legislation almost state by which rules you've got. You're either pure DC, and if you're not pure DC, you get caught by a whole load of DB, defined benefit and debt stuff. I made inquiries of Holland because they thought I got the message that was actually changing. When I made the inquiries 2 years ago, it wasn't. They had the same problems we had. Has there been any progress in that area?
Yeah, exactly. Understand the question.
Sorry, Paul. Could you just repeat the question there? It's about the benefits that are actually being provided, is it?
Not the actual benefits. What the legal structure of the scheme is in the UK. If you're a pure DC scheme, there's a whole pile of simple legislation which is quite easy and simple in your pure DC. The second you move away from that and put some hybrid underpin or offer a bit of guarantee, you become a defined benefit scheme and you get caught by what was minimum funding standards, now statutory funding objective, debt on the employer, and all those complicated defined benefit provisions and regulatory provisions.
So the question is there a legal structure in the Netherlands that makes this work in a way perhaps it doesn't?
Yeah. Shall I answer?
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I think if you look at the current DB structure, which is the DB structure is regulated by the Dutch Central Bank, and it's quite tough regulations. But it's only tough up to the amount that you promise things. So if you say, well, we promise retirees that they get their pension, as they are the current retirees, but the actives, they write off their pensions if things go bad and their rights, and they increase their rights when things go well, that's all within the legal structure and the regulations that are now within accepted in Holland. For example, we have the medical pension funds, where in fact there is no employer, but the people who are in the medical, the doctors, are also the employees and the employer. They pay, and that's already a collective DC. And they write off if things go bad, they write off their pension rights. If things go well, they get indexation higher than the inflation level, for example. So, and that's all within the legal structure of a defined benefit pension fund, under the regulations of the Dutch Central Bank. So in that respect, I think it's a feasible solution. And maybe you can add to that?
Yeah, what I could add, but that is, if you go to the continent, don't mention what I said. But many of my clients really think that all these developments with respect to collective defined contribution, etc., have only two causes, and that was the reason why I mentioned these are not the causes, and that is, they say, the accountants in the first place and the regulator in the second place. Because accountants are on fair value, and the volatilities of today, although they are rather low from an historic point of view, for the companies they are still rather large due to the leverage in the pension fund. And the new Dutch law, which is now active for a few weeks, states that if a pension fund have an underfunding, then in one way or the other it should be repaired in 3 years' time. And if you have a deficit of 10% gross domestic product, it does not make a large difference whether you have to pay it in 1 year or in 3 years. So for many organizations, that is one of the reasons that they go to those new schemes. But my point is, these are not the real causes, but many of my clients will say so, the regulators and the accountants. I do say that the risk has become so large that the people have to carry a large part of it themselves and make proper rules about that. That is actually my whole presentation in one sentence.
Thank you.
Donald Duval from Aon. I think both presentations are extremely interesting. The problems are, I think, if anything, probably bigger here than in the Netherlands. The rate of withdrawal of employers from defined benefit schemes is faster here. I really have yet to meet an employer who honestly believes defined benefit is going to survive in the UK. The specific thing that I want to ask about is Gus's description, which I found extremely helpful, of the non-equality of the accumulation of risk with the total risk being borne, and that is where all the stress is coming from. It gives, I think, a very useful framework for analysis for trustees to look at as to who's bearing what risks. But you mentioned that with conditional indexation, people are taking a risk for which they are not being rewarded. But isn't it inevitable when you're adjusting from a position when the individual risks don't sum to the total, that you're going to have to give people risks with either no reward at all or with inadequate reward for the risk that you're now giving them?
The question is actually, in a large extent, the remark of this gentleman over here. Because if you look at the asset liability project, and in expectation, everything goes smoothly very well, even if you are rather prudent about the equity risk premium. And in the many studies that we do, that is due to the fact that the contribution is high. In some cases, maybe, if you keep that a secret as well, too high. So in expectations, things go very well. And then you can really have the problem that if things go wrong, the participants will pay, because the sponsor in collective defined contribution withdrew. But if they do not make arrangements what to do if things go right, and in expectations things will go right, then we have the risk that the expected returns or the expected overreturns will not go to the party who bear the risk. So for that reason, I want to make these arrangements to specify these arrangements today, so that if things go right, the money goes to the people who bear the risk and not to some other organization. That's really a problem. Suppose, take for example ABP, this is not secret at all. The contribution at ABP is fixed. So that one of the largest pension funds in the world, without explicitly knowing, is a collective defined contribution scheme, because the contribution is fixed. The Minister of Finance just simply says, I cannot pay €1 more than what he pays today. But now suppose that the funded ratio of ABP becomes 200%. What will happen now with the money? I do not think that it will go to the participants. I do not think that it will go to the pensioners. I do think that it will go to the Minister of Finance. So that is a dishonest thing in the pension scheme. If things go wrong, indexation is either skipped, and if things go very wrong, there is also a little sentence in the law that then pension rights will be decreased. And the minister will not pay them more, because that will ruin our country, and that is not possible. So we have a serious risk that there is a large asymmetry in the pension deal of one of the largest pension funds in the world. And those people know, of course, and they talk about it at their own presentations, but that does not change it immediately.
Okay.
So we should do that today.
I think it's after the last question.
Thank you, Bob Tardy. Very interesting, the situation in the Netherlands, and there are contrasts, of course, with the UK. One area that you haven't focused on much, and that's probably because you've been focusing on the fund, is the role of regulation in driving the direction of redesign of pension funds. And I think one of the key differences between the Dutch situation and the UK is a different regulatory environment. I'm just wondering how you see the current regulatory environment as driving this change, and how do you think they should be doing it differently? And one particular point I'd like to highlight is that in the Netherlands, the design of the PVK, now the DNB, for a risk-based system, you know, very much like Solvency II, in the UK, the risk aspect is fairly ignored. The PPF levy is based on, you know, how good is the sponsor. So there's a very distinct difference between those two regimes. And I was just wondering your views on how that should change going forward.
Yeah, both. Of course. How should I say that? maybe I'll tell you the following story. In the year 2002, the chairman of the PVK, so what is now the Dutch Central Bank, he wrote a paper to all the pension funds and said, well, the last 2 years were not so good. They were dramatic, of course, in terms of equity returns and the interest rates. And he said, well, now we are really going to carry out the law which we had already for decades, but never applied. And he stated in that letter, all the deficits have to be gone in 8 years, one way or the other. And then I got with my organization a very interesting contract, because we have about 1,000 pension funds, and all the 1,000, they joined together, and we were able to carry out a project for all the 1,000 pension funds, and that was computing the effect of the letter of the Dutch Central Bank. And that would ruin the Dutch economy. That was the outcome of the letter. So there was an enormous fight between the pension funds and the regulator, with very bad results, of course. And then the other supervisor of Theo's PhD, by then the CIO of ABP Pension Fund, he brought the two parties, all the pension funds and the regulator, again together, because he stated at the open conference that it was a disgrace that the pension funds needed such a bad letter for the regulator to carry out the reforms which they should have done anyway. Because then the regulator was pleased, of course, that the letter was right anyway. So I do think that pension funds are just like normal people. If you take, for example, my life, I will not give you any examples, but I do know that I should do some things, and sometimes if you get a push, it helps. And that is also the case with the regulator. So, therefore, my point, it is not due to the regulator, it is not due to the accountants. I do think there are real problems which we should solve. And the regulators and the accountants help, and what is unpleasant, they exaggerate, of course.
Yeah, well, there are two things about regulations. One is the accounting regulation, so to speak, the accounting rules. I think that has driven the DB schemes into closing in the UK. Not so much the regulations, because the regulations are much more lenient than in Holland. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that this... So the accounting was... IFRS 17 was here before it was in Holland. And that may be probably also a sign for Holland that they may go in the same direction. And so that's the accounting, but it's only the messenger of something that was already happening. And then the regulations, I think, in the regulations leave enough room, at least in Holland, for collective DC. So as long as the reason for the regulations is, if you promise something, you have to give it. If you don't promise it, you don't have to give it. That's the, and as long as they don't stick to all kind of rules that you have to promise it, but you can, if you can make promises conditional, and that's why you don't need, it's not an underfunded situation, that would could save the system. So the Dutch Central Bank, I have two meetings the next 2 months with a whole large groups of the Dutch Central Bank to talk about this issue and how it will work in practice. And hopefully that the same could happen here in the UK. And by the way, I think the PPF is not working at all, just like the PPGC is not working at all. I mean, I think that they should. The same discussion happened in only they made a slightly adjustment in the levy, but not as much as I would like to. And what you said is not risk based. It's astonishing because we talk to these people about all kind of things, and there are very smart people working there who want to do it as it should. But apparently, there's all kind of politics involved.
Right. I think that may be a very good point to draw an end to the discussion, and there'll be plenty of opportunity to continue over refreshments in a minute. But before I ask you to join me in thanking our speakers in the normal way, I promised you advertisements for a couple of future events. The first one is a joint event between the Institute and faculty here, between Inquire, the Institute for Quantitative Investment Research, and the UK Society of Investment Professionals on Thursday, the 22nd of February, the subject Absolute Return Strategies for Funds with Defined Liabilities. And the second one, so that's one date for you, Di, 22nd of February here. The other one is the 20th of March, which should also be here. It's another joint event with Premier called Can the Capital Market Deliver Appropriate Solutions to Longevity Risk?
Can they? Can they?
If you come back on the 20th of March, maybe we'll have an answer. And this gentleman will be one of the speakers who will be able to... So I hope you'll be able to come to those events as well. But I should say thank you very much to our speakers for a very interesting discussion. I am very pleased. Refreshments at the back.